Okay, let's see. Where are we? All running. Okay, I didn't forget, so we're recording. And it is April 13th, and we're finishing up chapter 5. And we're going to do Fisher projections, and then we'll move into chapter 6 and look at energy and kinetics a little bit. All right, and before I start, maybe I should stop and ask, does anybody have any questions and how things are going? Just checking in with everybody. I hope everybody had a good Easter, although a socially distant Easter, different than what we would normally expect. But I hope everybody is doing well and staying healthy and doing okay. Nice. All right, I'm getting a lot of thumbs up. Okay. Let me go ahead then, if there's no questions, and you guys want to just jump in and start. Let's do some Fisher projections. Okay, so this is, I've got the wrong glasses on. I can't see what I'm doing. This is chapter 5 still, the end of chapter 5, Fisher projections. And I can never remember if it's supposed to have a C in it or not, but I'm going to leave the C in and we're going to call it good. Fisher projections. All right. For carbohydrates have many stereocenters. And so if we draw a carbohydrate and we take and look at D-glucose, for instance, if we draw it out in a line drawing, what we find is that there are many different stereocenters on this molecule. So I have 1, 2, 3, 4 different stereocenters on the molecule. It's 6 carbons all together. And to draw it out, so this is a lowercase d glucose. And we talked about what that lowercase d means, that the lowercase d means how the molecule is structured in terms of its last stereocenter, farthest away from the most oxidized functional group. We need a way to be able to draw this so as to interpret it more easily than the line drawing, and that's what the Fisher projection is. So what we can do is we can take this and translate the molecule into still a three-dimensional drawing, but what we're going to do is go through a series of manipulations in order to be able to rotate it into a specific sort of orientation. So I'm going to put in all of the hydrogens, as well as hydroxyl groups, which makes it a little bit harder to see at first, but will help us in terms of what we need to do next. Oops, that's supposed to be hydrogen. And an OH there. And on this last carbon, we can also think of this as having 2 hydrogens on the last carbon, on the tail carbon, and a hydrogen out on the aldehyde end. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take, and instead of drawing it as a line drawing where we have the regular angles, what we're going to do is try to let the molecule sort of curl in on itself like that. We're going to take and rotate each one of these groups in order to get the groups all pointed in the same direction. So we're going to rotate a lot of bonds. And as we go through and rotate those bonds, what we're going to get is a structure that is going to have 6 carbons. So there's carbon number 1, 2, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So there's the 6 carbons. And on each functional group now, because we have rotated it, the stereo groups are going to all point towards us, But what that means is, as they all point towards us, we need to make sure that we are rotating them appropriately. So for instance, the first carbon has not changed. So there's carbon number one. Both legs were pointed in a downwards orientation, and they are still pointed in a downwards orientation. So the stereocenter is unchanged. But when I move to the next stereocenter, let's color this one blue. This one had both groups pointed upwards, going towards it. And instead, they're both now going to be coming down. And so that means that I have rotated the group, and the hydroxyl group that was forward. So there's, whoops, that is not what I wanted to do. I want pink, really. There's the hydroxyl group that was forward. That hydroxyl group is now backwards because I have rotated it down and turned it back behind. And each functional group, I'm going to have to do that as I move through these different functional groups. So I'm going to unclutter some of my markings that I made. And I'm going to go through and I'm going to do the next carbon. So I'm going to focus on this carbon now here. And that carbon, the hydroxyl group, is sort of unrotated, still pointing both down, still pointing both down. So that one I'm going to not change, and it is going to come forward. And the hydroxyl group is going to go back. The last one is just the two hydrogens. And so they fit in there. And so what I've got now is, let me just color code each one of these. So I have the stereocenter here, here. We'll switch to blue here and here. And let's do green. And I lost a stereocenter. Or did I? No, I skipped one. Okay, you guys aren't keeping me honest. Remember, you're supposed to be checking me. Blue is here. Green is here. And that means that I'm missing a stereocenter in my molecule, so I need to do one more bond. That's why we check. There's the terminal end. And now I need a color. Let's do hot pink, purplish for there. Okay, so this one is getting turned around. So the hydroxyl group is going to come forward and the hydrogen is going to go back as I rotate them. Okay, so now I've rotated everything appropriately and I'm checking my model just to make sure that it is accurate with what I intended to do, and it is. And basically what we're doing is we're treating this like a caterpillar. And we're saying that all the legs, so all of these legs, are all pointed the same direction. And I'm using legs sort of as substituents. Pointed same direction. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to artificially splay it flat. I'm going to take the molecule and orient it in a flat way. However, give me 1 second. My recording from this morning's lab just finished its transcription. And so I need to save it really quickly and get it off my screen so I can keep doing everything else I'm supposed to do. Come on, drive, Chem 12, lab recordings. Okay, back in business. All right, so now what we're going to do is we're going to take this molecule and I am going to pull the legs of this molecule sort of all down and orient it almost like a caterpillar now walking with a whole ton of legs. So basically what I'm going to do is make my four different stereo centers. And then I will have my OH group on the tail end. And I have an OH, which is forward, hydrogen back, H forward, OH back. And then the OHs, the two next OHs are forward. And I need a little bit of more space here, because these guys are kind of bumping into each other. So I need to just write a little bit smaller. So we'll do it this way. H, O, H. This one is an H, O, H, H, O, H, H. Okay. Now what I've got is a molecule which is got the groups forwards and backwards and artificially splayed flat. From there, what I do is I orient it vertically rather than horizontally. So I'm going to take the whole molecule and I'm going to orient the molecule with the most oxidized carbon at the top. And then at each junction, these groups are going to point towards me like little bow ties. So I'm going to take the feet and orient the feet all towards me. And as I pick that up, I'm going to find that the hydroxyl group fall in these locations and that the hydrogens fall like that. So following that color coding, it should be good now. Okay. Everybody with me in terms of how I'm orienting this? And each of these feet now, each of these legs are pointed towards me. Which is why they are both sides, left side and right side, have a wedge bond coming out towards me, because I have literally picked up the molecule and I am looking at the molecule from this side, from the bottom side, and then standing it up with the most oxidized carbon up so that the feet are all coming towards me. This is what we interpret as a Fischer projection, and we interpret it this way, such that the most oxidized carbon goes up, and then the hydroxyls fall either left or right sides on a straight bond, which means that all the legs are coming out towards me. And at the bottom side, I have a CH2OH. These drawings are now all the same drawing. And so what we mean by a bond that is going across like this, this is interpreted to mean a bond where the two legs are coming out towards me. And that is the Fischer projection. So Fischer projections are an artificial way of orienting the molecule such that the most oxidized carbon goes up, the molecule backbone is splayed flat, and all of the legs, all of the substituents are pointed towards you. That is the Fischer projection. And in the Fischer projection, the most oxidized carbon on the last stereocenter, whether it be on the right or the left, tells you whether it is a D or an L. So this is a lowercase d with hydroxyl on the right side. It doesn't tell you about any of the other stereocenters and the configuration at any of the other stereocenters. It only tells you the configuration of the last stereocenter. That's what the D and the L do, and that is what we had covered in the last lecture, at the end of the last lecture, and talking about the different nomenclature types. So Francisco, how do you determine which is the most oxidized? Okay, so in terms of oxidation, that we can go from a CH bond to a CO bond to a C double bond. Oxidation is the loss of hydrogen or the gain of oxygen. We can also look at it in terms of oxidation number so that we can figure out the oxidation number for a particular carbon. And the higher the oxidation number, the more oxidized, the higher the oxidation number in terms of positive number, the more oxidized it is. But I tend not to use the oxidation numbers itself. I tend to just look at the molecule and look at what is connected to each carbon. The more oxygen that is connected to a carbon, the higher oxidized that carbon is. So that we typically think of, like methane, and then going to, no, I don't want to do it that way. I was just trying to think about different ways of thinking about oxidized carbons. It's just the number of oxygens that are connected to a carbon is the easiest way to do it for right now. So when we look at all of these carbons, each carbon has one oxygen on it. The carbon at the top, which is, I want to choose orange, which is this guy here. This one has the double bond to the oxygen, and that makes it the carbonyl, and that is the most oxidized of the carbons. It's just how many carbons are actually attached to the oxygen. So in which case, that's usually going to be the ketone or aldehyde that is going to be placed at the top, and the other hydroxyl groups will be down at the bottom. So that's our most oxidized carbon. So what do I need to do here in terms of Fischer projections? Let's look at an easier Fischer projection. So let's take a molecule that is not a carbohydrate, but that has two stereocenters, two bromides. And let's draw the Fischer projection for this molecule. So as we go through and orient this molecule, I would think about the other things that are attached to it. I would first go through and rotate it so that those groups are pointed in the same directions. So what that means is that the bromide is going to change to the front of the molecule. I would orient it in a flat, artificial manner with the groups pointed like this. Bromide, hydrogen. And then I would take and I would rotate it and stand that up with the aldehyde at the top, my two cross pieces, and then both bromides are going to be on the right-hand side because I am looking at it from the bottom this way. That means when I stand it up and rotate it with the legs pointed towards me, both bromides are pointed on the right-hand side, hydrogens are on the left, and that would be the Fischer projection. All right, taking that Fischer projection, what I could do is now it is very easy to compare two Fischer projections and to decide whether or not the molecules are the same enantiomers or diastereomers. So if we take the molecule that I just drew, where both bromides are on the right, and I want to draw the mirror image of this molecule in its Fischer projection, then it becomes very easy to simply draw the mirror image, putting both bromides on the left, and these two would be a pair of enantiomers. If I take and compare two Fischer projections, starting with our original molecule, and the molecule that I am comparing it against, looks like this, then what I have is one stereocenter that is flipped and one stereocenter that is not. So if I look at this guy, that guy is the same. However, these two have flipped. And so these two are diastereomers. They are not mirror images and they are not superimposable. So it becomes very easy within these to look at enantiomers versus diastereomers in terms of Fischer projections. And let's see, what else do I need to do with Fischer projections? That's really about it. It's just that Fischer projections are generally used for looking at carbohydrates. Because of their many polyhydroxy compounds, it makes it a whole lot easier to be able to draw them in a Fischer projection than it does to be able to look at them in a bond line formula. And so that's where Fischer projections are frequently used, are for carbohydrates and for comparing carbohydrates. So when you see tables of carbohydrate structures and names of the carbohydrates, such as D-glucose, the molecules are almost always represented in a Fischer projection as opposed to any other type of representation. So that we have hydroxyl group, let's see. This one is back to the D-glucose. CH2OH, so this one being D-glucose. And if I draw its enantiomer, where I flip them all. Nope, that's supposed to be OH on that side. This one is L-glucose. And these two are enantiomers. But one of the questions that I would have is that this has four different stereocenters. So if you have four different stereocenters, that means 2^4. That's 2 × 2 × 2. 2 × 2 = 4, 2 × 2 = 8, 2 × 2 = 16. 16 different isomers are represented by this structural formula. So that there are 16 different molecules which are classified as, this is an aldo hexose, aldo meaning aldehyde, and hexose meaning 6-carbon carbohydrate. So this is an aldo hexose, and there are 16 different aldo hexoses which have the exact same formula as D-glucose and L-glucose. We are only looking at one pair of those enantiomers. There would be 8 other pairs of enantiomers. I think there's actually a meso compound in there too, so I need to be careful of that. Maybe not. No, there's no plane of symmetry. Take it back. There's no plane of symmetry. So 16 different carbohydrates. Most organic chemistry classes, when they get into the carbohydrate section, have you memorize all 16 of those aldo hexoses? And I've never gotten into memorization, so I don't usually make you guys do that. But just so that you know, that there are 16 different sugars, and D-glucose is just one of those 16 different sugars. And that is the natural sugar that is the only fuel source for our brains. Our brains only use glucose, which is why when diabetics run low on glucose, they get that typical bonking sensation where they can't think, they get lightheaded, they get dizzy, and can go into a diabetic coma from having their blood glucose levels go too low, because the brain literally stops functioning because it has no fuel. It's the only sugar that makes it through the blood-brain barrier. And anyway, so that's Fisher projections. Any questions in Fisher projections there? We're not going to do a whole lot with it right now. It's really just to give you an overview so that you've seen it once. And then when we come back to it later on, in later sections in second semester, then you have an idea of what Fisher projections are, and I don't have to teach it from scratch. We can kind of go back into our working memory and pull back Fisher projections and just do a quick little reminder, and then everybody's up and running. Okay, if there's nothing more in that, then that is the end of chapter 5. And that takes us into chapter 6, which is energy. Okay, so chapter 6, I need to grab new notes. I was not prepared to switch notes over that quickly. Hang on a second. Finley and I are gonna go grab the next set of notes. Check what time it is, see how much we've got. Okay, so with chapter 6, here what we're looking at is energy. And it's just an overview. This is to get us into, Katrina, would you be able to post practice problems for chapter 5, stuff learned post midterm 1? So sort of where we are from midterm 1, what things are what have we gone over? Yeah. Let me see what I can do there. Yeah, I'll see what I can do. Maybe I can put together a little chapter review thing. And it's stereochemistry problems. So again, the best practice place for problems for chapter 5 is going to be the OChem as a Second Language book. The first semester topics has great stereochemical practice in that book. Also, at the end of chapter 5 within Pavia, all the problems are good within Pavia, but the OChem as a Second Language book is probably the first book that I would start with and the first place to go for practice problems. And if you don't have that, I might have it here, and I might be able to pull some problems and put some problem sets together too. So I'll see what I can do, but I would not rely on my problems as being the sole practice. You need more problems than that. So I would always try to extend out and go as many problems as you can, which means just working the problems in the back of the textbook and working the problems in OChem as a Second Language, and then whatever else I happen to send out on top of that is what I would do. And I know it's challenging in this format that we seem to be a little bit more self-regulating, and that is not easy for everybody. My daughter in particular is having an extraordinarily difficult time with her classes at Western Washington, because they have all mostly moved to a flipped classroom sense, where the students are expected to do all the studying out of the classroom, and then they're using the Zoom sessions more as problem-solving sessions and not really even doing a lot of problem-solving there. Some of her instructors have even just used and switched to using the textbook slides and the reader for the textbook, which is just having an electronic voice read the slides rather than having anything else. And she is just absolutely dying, particularly in her chemistry class, which I'm having to go back and reteach a lot of and try to help her survive it, because there's just zero support. I don't know what they're doing, but most of the instructors are not figuring out how to use Zoom or how to figure out how to write. And those that can are writing on like a music stand with the camera behind them, so that their hand is over what they're writing. You can't even see what they're writing, and you can't see the instructor's face because their back is to the camera. And it's just been a disaster. So So I know that this is not an easy mode to learn in, and I sympathize with you, absolutely. Dina, what is that? You are seriously never advanced in your teaching?
My bad. I meant to say you're seriously advanced in your teaching compared to other teachers.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
Pardon my grammar.
I'll take all the love I can get there. Thank you. We're trying. But I know that still on your end, that you have been removed from all of your learning communities. And that it is, I know this, that it is the learning communities more than anything that really helps OCHEM work. And that working together in groups is one of the things that got me through chemistry and got me through math and got me through all the calculus classes and things. And that it was my learning communities and my sitting down at regular times with my group of friends and studying and bantering and moving it forward and drinking tea until wee hours in the morning when I finally had to switch to port so I could get the caffeine out of my body and go to sleep and counter it with something, that it was those learning communities that really pulled me through it. So I would encourage you guys to maybe even get together via Zoom to do some study sessions and start using Zoom with two or three other people to try to actually work on some of these quizzes, work on the co-ops, work on the study problems from in the OCHEM as a Second Language. Get together with people who have that OCHEM as a Second Language book and just take some screenshots and work some of the problems out of it. And find a time when you guys come together at a regular time, every day or every other day, at least on Monday and, well, maybe Monday and Wednesday, you're burned out by the end of it. But find a time to come together and do some Zoom chats or Google Hangout where it doesn't cut you off and hang out together and go through and do these problems. I think that more than anything, now more than ever, we kind of need each other to help pull us through these, that it's so hard just sitting at home by yourself to go through and study. I know that I'm struggling just in the work that I'm supposed to do, trying to find the emotional bandwidth to be able to jump into it and do it. And I'm struggling to be able to make myself do that. So I can only imagine how it feels on your end to have these things and to try to do it on your own. So I think that's too why I'm not feeling bad about putting take-home quizzes and take-home exams and having you guys work together on these things, because anything that I can do that's going to stimulate learning is going to be of benefit to you all. Anything that I do that stifles that is just going to crush it and make it harder. And so I think that at this time in particular, working together and finding ways to come together is going to be of huge benefit. So I would encourage you to keep doing that. That's my little pep talk, all right? Okay, let's ask—
Thanks for the motivational speech.
Yeah, just— Once in a while, I get up on my soapbox and I climb up on the soapbox and I give you the emotional speech and I gotta grab my pom poms and we gotta do the like little cheerleader pom pom thing.
We definitely need it.
Yeah, I hear it. So keep working together and do it. Do as much of that as you can. Okay, including on the quizzes. Just go out and crush it. I don't care if everybody's getting A's. If everybody's learning together, that is suiting me just fine. That's what I want. Okay. All right, let's jump into chapter 6. So this first part of chapter 6 is going to be a little Chem 1B flashback. And I hope that steel yourself a little bit. No panic attacks. Don't run out screaming. Because we're not going to use this. Oh, no, yeah, exactly. We're not going to use this to the degree that I'm about to present it. But I need to present it so that we have a baseline with which to move forward to. So I want to make sure that we're all on the same page. And like I said, some of these concepts I will talk about once in a while, but mostly this is just in order to get us on the same page. Okay, so let's talk enthalpy for a minute. This is delta H. And when we think about enthalpy, delta H, this is the change in heat. So we use the change in Q. And the change in enthalpy is about the stored energy within the chemical bonds. This is bond making and bond breaking. So if we think about bond breaking, this requires energy. And we can think about this in two different types of processes. We can think about it as homolytic. And in the homolytic, we have X bound to Y, and we can break this bond homolytically. So I'm going to use one electron transfers. So I switch to my arrows to be using a fishhook type arrow. And what I'm doing is I'm breaking the bond down the center homolytically, which takes me to two different radical species, X plus Y, both free radicals. So these are the free radical. And most of the time, when we look at a bond enthalpy table, the bond enthalpy table is based on homolytic bond cleavages, not heterolytic. Heterolytic is where we have X bound to Y, and it fractures asymmetrically, where two electrons go to one of the species, generally the more electronegative of the species, such that I end up with ions, X plus and Y minus. So here we end up with the ions. Okay, Linnea sent out something. I can also send photos of the OCAM book as a second language to anyone that needs it or feels it would help them. That book is her best friend and should be yours too. Okay. And I believe that Linnea has my copy of OCAM as a second language for the first semester. I think I might have a second copy, but Linnea might be the only one that has the copy right now, and she can send out some of the important chapters in that. It is a great book. And yeah, I would definitely use those problems first to start with and then move to the textbook. Even though they're written by the same author, they're better in the OCAM as a second language book. And they start off at a lower level and they progress through to a higher level, and they're great. So hook up with Linnea for some screenshots of that if you need it. Okay, bond association energies can be looked up in the enthalpy tables. So remember also that when we have a change in enthalpy that is negative, that this is exothermic. That is energy given off. And that the change in enthalpy, which is positive, is endothermic. And this is energy absorbed by the system. Okay. So we have our enthalpy terms, and that predicting the enthalpy of a reaction is important, but we're not going to use it. So we can also say, just so that you have it, predicting delta H is important, but we aren't going to do that. Okay. Entropy. Entropy is delta S. This is the degree of disorder. Remember that entropy is not a measure of order, but a measure of disorder, and that the universe always tends towards more disorder, so that things do not go back to ordered systems. The one sort of diagram that we use to represent that all the time is this sort of diagram where we have blue dots, a gas of one type on one side, and of another type on another side, and that when we release the pin, what happens in releasing the pin is the two gases are allowed to mix. And as they are allowed to mix, they go to a more disordered state, a more random state, and that it doesn't go back. So here we release the bar, and blue dots are now on both sides, as are red dots, and they are evenly interspersed. And the system has gone to a higher disorder. And that it doesn't go back. So once we go to these high disorder states, they generally do not go back into an ordered state, that the tendency of the universe is towards disorder. And the way that we can phrase that is that the change in entropy total is equal to the change in entropy of a system plus the change in entropy of the surroundings. And that for any process in which the total change in entropy is positive, meaning increasing, that that is a spontaneous process. So that if you have kids and you clean their room and they then go back in and reoccupy that room after you have cleaned it, 5 minutes from cleaning it, the room is destroyed and it does not spontaneously go back to being ordered again. The kids just do not put the room back into order. And so the spontaneousness is the breakdown of the room into chaos, into disorder. And that is a spontaneous process. So as the change in entropy is positive, that is a spontaneous process. There are many different types of changes in entropy that we can see within an organic system. We can have a system go through a decomposition reaction. So decomposition is an increase in entropy. So we went from one thing to two things. So we can think about that as an increase in entropy. We can also think about a system where I have two components that are linked together, and we can break this chain, this ring system. And as we break the ring system, there are now more degrees of freedom in the linear molecule because there is allowed rotation now. So because there are more degrees of freedom, this is an increase in entropy. So there are many different types of ways of looking at chemical reactions and systems that demonstrate an increase in entropy. I could write it up above. So these are systems that demonstrate an increase in entropy. Okay, so with that, I want to do a little derivation. And what I want to do is start with this equation, delta S total is equal to delta S of the surroundings plus delta S of the system. And what we're going to do is that we're going to say that delta S of the surroundings is equal to the change in enthalpy of the system divided by T. Actually, it's the negative, so I need a negative sign out there. So what this says is that the change in entropy, the change in the disorder of the surroundings, is equal to the negative value of the change in entropy of the system divided by the temperature. And basically what that is saying is that as energy goes in and out of the system, that energy is absorbed by the surroundings and will either cool the surroundings or heat the surroundings. And if we heat the surroundings, we have an increase in entropy of the surroundings. If we decrease the temperature, we have a decrease in the entropy of the surroundings. And so it is linked to how much heat the system gives off. also divided by the temperature in there. So that's where that comes from. So if we take that and we plug that in, we can say now that delta S total is equal to minus delta H of the system divided by T plus the delta S of the system. So basically now what we have done is we have changed the equation to be the change in entropy total is equal to the change in enthalpy of the system plus the change in entropy of the system. So we have translated the change in entropy total to the change in entropy of just the system. Finley is determined to put his nose on top of my iPad, which is making it really hard to write. Buddy, you and I need to come to an agreement here on how we work, if you're gonna stay here. Okay, so once we have this, what I wanna do now is I wanna take and multiply both sides by minus delta T. So I'm gonna change colors, and I am going to multiply negative T by that side, and I'm gonna multiply negative T by the right-hand side as well. So what I'm gonna get now is I'm going to get negative T delta S total is equal to this guy is going to cancel the negative and the denominator. So this will just turn into delta H of the system. And then that is going to be minus T delta S of the system. It's supposed to be SYS for some reason. Okay, there we go. All right, so what this is actually Gibbs free energy. This is delta G. Delta G is equal to delta H of the system minus T delta S. And that's for the system. And this piece, the delta H, is telling me about the change in entropy of the surroundings. And this piece is telling me about the change in entropy of the system. And so what I've done is I've gone through and I have derived Gibbs free energy equation starting from just the total change in entropy based on the change in entropy of the surroundings and the change in entropy of the system. And what Gibbs free energy tells me is it tells me about spontaneity. So for spontaneity, remember, for a spontaneous process, delta S total needs to be a positive value. And therefore, if I look at minus T delta S, which is equal to delta G, because of the negative sign, this means that delta G must equal a negative value for spontaneity. So that's where delta G, or why delta G needs to be negative for a spontaneous reaction. And also, when we look at delta G, if delta G equals a negative value, we say that this is exergonic. And if it's a positive value, it's endergonic. Meaning exergonic, a release in energy. Or endergonic, an increase in energy. Absorption of energy, that's really what I want to say. And the difference between delta G and delta H is that we're looking at the overall energy, whereas delta H is really just the enthalpy, the heat energy. And so we're looking at heat passing in or out, whereas delta G takes into account all types of energy, including the entropy. And so the entropy is a big component of that. Okay, so that Gibbs free energy is really telling us about entropy changes. And what we find is that enthalpy, heat changes, can be a driving force for chemical reactions, as can entropy, or the degree of disorder within a system, can also be a driving force for a chemical reaction. Both things are true. Both things can be driving forces. And throughout organic chemistry, we will see both things be driving forces for chemical reactions. Okay, so that was a little bit there. Now, equilibria, we need to talk for a minute. And I know I'm kind of leaning over against the camera, but Finley is, I don't even know if I can show you guys where Finley is. Finley's hanging out here. And he's watching everything that I'm doing, but he's making it so I can't be centered. So I'm leaning a little to the side here in order to get these notes. Yeah, no, we know Finley runs everything. Finley's running the show now. Okay, equilibria. If we have A plus B goes to make C plus D, then what we can write is that we can write the reaction quotient. So Q is equal to the concentration of C times the concentration of D all over concentration of A times concentration of B. Oh, and remember there are coefficients here, A, B, C, and D, and those little C, little D, little A, little B become the exponents on those concentrations, and that at equilibrium, that Q is equal to K equilibria, and so these are the equilibrium concentrations. And so these are the concentrations at equilibrium, C, and we'll say EQ for equilibrium concentration, D, and A, and finally B. So those are our equilibrium concentrations. And that K equilibrium is determined by delta G. Such that delta G gives free energy is equal to minus RT ln, where do we have it here? ln K equilibrium, where R is equal to 8.314 joules per mole Kelvin. Okay, so that the equilibrium constant is determined by delta G. All right, that's enough for equilibria. I just wanted to remind us about the equilibrium and how that looks and what that is. And remember that equilibrium is telling us about the state of a chemical reaction, so that in terms of our equilibrium, we have reactants and products. And it's telling us about the state, the equilibrium state, on whether the reactants or the products are favored. So that when I look at that equilibrium constant, K equilibrium here is going to be a value which, if the products are favored, is much greater than one. And if the reactants are favored, K equilibrium is a value which is much less than one. So we have this sort of sense of, and that's linked up to delta G. Okay, reaction rates have to do with kinetics, speed. So in kinetics, Finley, in kinetics, we're looking at the rate of a chemical reaction, and that this is equal to the rate constant times the concentration of the reactants which is equal to K times concentration of A to the X times B to the Y. And that for a first order, we get that the rate is equal to K times the concentration of just A. In a second order, it would be equal to K times A times B, or sometimes K times A squared, that there's two components there. In a third order rate reaction, this is going to be equal to K times the concentration of A squared times B, something like that. And that the rate, the K, rate constant, is affected by the activation energy, the temperature, and the sterics of any given chemical reaction. All right, energy diagrams. And I know Francisco is probably dying to ask some questions in here because he was asking some questions before in office hours. And I'm kind of moving through these a little bit quickly because they're just review and because I want us all to be on the same page, but I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on those subjects. It's really the energy diagrams and something from the energy diagrams that I'm most interested in getting to. And you say, well, why didn't I just jump to those? Well, because all these other concepts were kind of wrapped up and important, and I just wanted to have them all in one place, and you can go back and review them and watch them and read the chapter, but I'm not going to rely on them so heavily. So let me jump into energy diagrams real quick, unless there are any questions, and Francisco just can't contain himself, or anybody else for that matter. I'm not going to single out Francisco, but if anybody else has any questions and they want to jump in there real quick, I'm happy to entertain those as well, which gives me an opportunity to drink something and not just keep talking. Nope, you guys are happy to let me go. All right, onwards and forwards then. Okay, energy diagrams. Within energy diagrams, we can look at reactants and products. And we can link these two together. And we can show where the activation energy, the transition state, this is energy on the y-axis, the reaction coordinate, on the x-axis, and that in kinetics, the E sub A is proportional to the rate. Okay, let me stop and ask for a second. Reaction coordinate. What is the reaction coordinate? Do you guys know what that actually is?
Is it when the reaction goes to completion?
Most people will say that it's time. And the reaction coordinate, what's on the axis here, this is really about bond length. Actually, I don't want to say bond length. Let's say internuclear distance. That's the better way to write this, is that this is about nucleus distance, such that if I'm looking at two nuclei, it is the distance between them that is equal to the reaction coordinate. That this graph doesn't tell you how long it takes for a chemical reaction to take place. It's not measured in time. It's measured in the internuclear distances as the reaction takes place. And you can measure any of the internuclear distances. Usually we pick the one through which the reaction is occurring, such as the two nuclei come close together and the reaction and the bond is formed, or the bond breaking process and how the two bonds are coming apart. But the reaction coordinate is always about an internuclear distance. between the nuclei of the reaction that is being undergone. That's what we typically look at. And so we have that where we have E sub A. We can also look, let's grab the same so as not to make the graph too crowded. Let's grab this and paste it down here. And instead of E sub A, what I want to look at is also delta G. And delta G is given by the G of the products minus G of the reactants. And that thermodynamics delta G is proportional to the equilibrium constant, or the equilibrium constant is proportional to delta G. So what we have here is we have kinetics, which is our rate, and that is about the E sub A value that is there. And in thermodynamics, which is, actually, I'm not gonna do thermodynamics, I'm gonna do that in blue. In thermodynamics, we have that this is related to the equilibrium constant, and it's about that difference in energy there. So we have our kinetics, which is relative to the activation energy, and our thermodynamics, which is related to the equilibrium constant and the delta G value. So those are two very, very important concepts to remember. And this is where I start getting interested and where it starts to relate to the organic chemistry that we're going to be dealing with. Okay, so let's see how those two things kind of come into play by combining them into one energy diagram. So what we'll look at is we'll take change in energy and two different products. We will have product C and product D. So this will be product D and product C. And this is our reactant, whatever it happens to be, and our reaction coordinate. These two materials can have two different activation energies for their formation, such that I could come down to this guy, or go up to this guy. So two different transition states. And we have a low activation energy for the formation there, and a much higher activation energy for the formation of D. And what we can say is that product C is a kinetic product. And by that, by saying that it's a kinetic product, what we're saying is that it is fast to form with a low activation energy. Again, because it's the blue activation energy. And that back up here, what we said was that rate was dependent upon the activation energy. So the lower the activation energy, the faster a product is to form. So that we could say that C is the fastest to form. Also here, what we can say is that product C is also the thermodynamic product. And that is the thermodynamic product because it is favored in equilibrium. And that has to do with its delta G. So that if I look over here, that the delta G for the formation of C is the most negative value. That it's a larger negative than for the formation of D. So maybe what I want to do too is change this to blue, style blue. And then we can look at the delta G, which I will do in red here to here. This is delta G for D, which is not as negative. It's a smaller number. And so the product C is also the thermodynamic product, which means that it's favored in equilibrium because it's a lower energy product that is going to give more energy out of it, is more exergonic than is D, the formation of D. So we can talk about both kinetic and thermodynamic nature of a product. So that's one of the things that I want to hit here, is that we look at both the kinetic and thermodynamic. Let's look at a different energy diagram and see how this could be different. So the energy diagram that I want to look at now is going to take and start off with our reactant or reactants. And what we will have is we will have C be here, but D be down here. And C is going to have a low activation energy. So this will be the low activation energy for formation of C. And D is going to have a high activation energy. Okay. So here's our low activation energy for the formation of C. And our high activation energy for the formation of D. And this is set up in a little bit of reverse from the last diagram. In this case, what we've got is we've got the kinetic product the fastest to form is the one with the lowest activation energy. That is C. C is the fastest to form because of its low activation energy. So we've got the low activation energy here, and that's my lowest E sub A, and that's product C. So C is the fastest to form. However, when I look at the thermodynamic, that product has the largest delta G. It's the most stable. And when I look up here at delta G, the one that's going to have the largest delta G is going to be D. And that D, having the largest delta G, is the most stable of the products, and that is the thermodynamic product. So largest delta G, most stable. And so what we find is that sometimes we get chemical reactions where one product is both kinetic and thermodynamic, and that product is favored under all conditions. So what we can say by this is that the outcome of this is that in this type of energy diagram, that C is favored under all conditions. It's always the major product. But that in certain types of conditions where my activation energies are different from my products, that I can get a situation where I can get two different types of products. I can get a kinetic product or a thermodynamic product. And that means that in kinetic is about speed. This is favored by low temperatures. And short reaction times. It's the product that is made first and fastest. And by having a low temp, you limit how much energy is in the system, which means by having a low temp, I can only have enough energy to be able to make it over the low energy barrier. So that's what we mean by low temp. So low temp favors lower activation energy. Short reaction time means the speed at which something is made. And so the thing that is made first in highest concentration is favored by a short reaction time. So all of these things are favoring the formation of C. But if we run it under what is called thermodynamic conditions, thermodynamic conditions are favored by high heat and long reaction times. And in that case, high heat is going to give me enough heat to be able to make it over this one. This is the high activation energy barrier. And long reaction times means that as this reaction is going forward, that C is made, but there's enough energy to go backwards to make reactants from C. So if you're following along with what I'm drawing, I'm just going to clean this up. Follow it this way. I make C first, but there's enough activation energy to be able to go back to reactants. But every once in a while, I can make products. And as I get over the product, I can't get back over the high activation energy for the backwards, which means D accumulates. As D accumulates, D becomes the major product. So D is favored by high heat and by long reaction times, and this makes D major. So there are kinetic conditions and there are thermodynamic conditions. And we can change those conditions to select for whatever product it is that we want when we have a kinetic versus thermodynamic type of setup of products. How do we know whether we are in a kinetic and thermodynamic all the same product versus kinetic product and a thermodynamic product becomes a subject of the next lecture. That's where we get into what's called the Hammond postulate. And starting to look at chemical reactions, and how do I look at a chemical reaction and know what type of condition I'm under, and how do I know what my energy diagram looks like for different chemical reactions? That all has to do with Hammond postulate, and that's the subject of the next lecture, and that's a great lecture and not one that you want to miss because it's one of my favorites in Hammond postulate. Just to give you a short story, that in grad school, you have to take kinetics, and you have to take thermodynamics. They're all part of physical chemistry. And in grad school, I had a professor, I'm gonna forget his name now. It'll come back to me in a minute. Anyway, this professor and Bogdan Singerong's group, who I was in, never got along. And all of Bogdan's students struggled in this class, and I was no exception. And the problem is that this professor, when he talked about kinetics and thermodynamics and all of these different properties, he always did it from the prospect of proton transfer, acid-base chemistry. And to me, acid-base chemistry was just crazy because it was acid-base. It just went, the proton just transferred. I didn't care how it transferred, it just transferred. It was an acid-base. It really didn't matter all that much. And And it was all based on Hammond postulate. And I could not understand for the life of me why Hammond postulate was so important until I started to teach organic chemistry. And I realized that you could not talk about any chemical reaction without actually talking about Hammond postulate. And it was just the limited nature of the way that this instructor went about it, looking at all proton transfers, because that was the subject of his research, that didn't allow me to see how important Hammond postulate was in the overall frame of organic chemistry and how powerful it is. It is the single most powerful postulate, really, in terms of understanding chemical reactions and energy changes and understanding the transition state that chemical reactions go through and what that transition state looks like in all of organic chemistry. So definitely, next lecture is the big one, and that's where we get to Hammond postulate, and that's where it's going to be fun. And that's where I'm going to cut it today. So I'm going to open it up, ask you guys if you have any questions. And I'm happy to stick around for another 5-10 minutes and answer any questions you've got. And other than that, we'll pick it up with Hammond postulate next time. And so make sure you come back. All right. Love you guys. Take care.
So Jason, I have a question right here for the last energy diagram. You say the activation energy, when it go down to the product D, it cannot go back.
Yes.
Is there a reason why?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Anne. Let me draw an energy diagram. Let me just take that energy diagram, copy it, and then I'll delete out some things and we'll clean it up and then we'll talk about why that's true. Okay, from this energy diagram, if I get rid of all of the stuff that's on here, and the delta G we don't need, so we can make delta G goes away because this is really about activation energies. Okay, when we look at the activation energy for the forwards versus the reverse, that's what you're asking about, Anne. And let's take and do the activation energies for the forward reactions in blue and the reverse for red. So I have an activation energy that looks like this for the forwards reaction. This would be the difference between the reactants and the transition state, which is at the top. So that's that activation energy. The activation energy for the reverse of that reaction is here. It is the E sub A. So this is for the reverse reaction, which would be going from C back to reactants. Does that make sense, Anne?
Yes.
Okay. So then when I take that and I translate that to product D, the activation energy for the formation of D is there. But the reverse reactivation and activation energy for D is all the way down here. So this is reverse. So that you can see that in terms of activation energies, that what I wind up getting is that the smallest activation energy is the forward to form C, and that activation energy is less than the activation energy to go reverse from C. That is lower than the activation energy to go forward to D, but that is less than the reverse from D. Which means that in order for D to go backwards to become reactants again, takes a tremendous amount of energy. This is the highest amount of energy. So that what happens is every time D gets formed, it does not go back to starting material. So that if I get rid of these energies now just a minute, just so that I can draw a couple more things on here, because it gets a little bit complicated with everything that's in there. Okay. when I make C, C very easily goes back to starting material, and it goes back and forth, such that I can say that these two are pretty equal because the activation energies are small and there's enough energy in the system to go back and forth. However, when there's enough energy in the system to go over to make D, D does not go back readily because the activation energy is too high. There is not enough energy in the system to be able to make it back over the activation energy to the reverse side to take D back to starting materials. Such that what winds up happening is, let's say that I have just a little picture here, and I have always wanted to make one of these as an actual sort of like game. Let's say that I have all of these spheres over here, which are the reactants, right? And as the reaction starts, a bunch of C winds up being made. But C goes back to being reactants very easily because the equilibrium between these two is such that they can go back and forth because the activation energy is fairly low. Another way to visualize this is to say that here's my Boltzmann distribution, and that my activation energy E sub A for C and the reverse E sub A for C are not all that different, that they're pretty close to each other, and that there's way enough energy in the system to be able to do that. But the formation of D is out here. Here's E sub A of D, and that the reverse reaction to go backwards, so here's E sub A reverse for D. And only a few molecules would be able to go in reverse. But what happens is, as these molecules are going, D starts to build up. And as D starts to build up, it's taking away these guys, and it just keeps building up, and they can't go backwards. And so this becomes what's called the thermodynamic sink, because they just keep acquiring until almost all of it has gone that direction.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's so cool. I got it.
Yeah, and they just can't go backwards. So that's how that works. That was a great question, Anne. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome. Anybody else have any questions? Sarah and Dina and Leticia and Matt, you all just hanging around waiting to see what questions are going to be asked. Got to soak up every last bit. I know how it goes. All right. If there's no more further questions, I would suggest that we adjourn and we'll pick it up for the afternoon lab. We'll take a break. And there's always office hours. I'll send out an invite for office hours in an hour at 1:30. You guys can always jump back in and see what else happens. Okay, you guys are awesome. I appreciate every single one of you. We'll see you later. You too, Dina. Thanks much.